We want to welcome Clint. We're looking forward to hearing his message.
Thank you, Ray. My name is Clint, and I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Clint.
And I'm glad to be here. I'm delighted that Pat and I were included in this celebration this weekend of your 35th annual conference for the Pacific Northwest AA and for your 40th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous in Oregon. This is an important time for me. This is an important place in my life. This is the first time I ever got thrown in jail was in Portland, Oregon. So this is not exactly a homecoming. It's more of a return to the scene of the crime tonight. I want to thank Mike, as I did personally, for his excellent talk. I admired the flower he was wearing. I noticed you gave Pat last night a flower for her to wear, and Bob had a flower this time. And I started to say, tomorrow morning, Bob B. will have his flower, but he just threw it up to me. That's where that came from. That's a wonderful gesture, Bob, and I thank you. It was. It's a gift. He just knows how to do that sort of thing. It's really perfect. I've enjoyed the conference very much so far, and it's kind of odd. I've heard every speaker and feel I know every speaker personally, with the exception of Mike, and he and I met just for the first time this weekend. But if you were here last night and heard my wife, Pat, you'll know what kind of a league I've been traveling in for a while now, and I love going first class. It's just wonderful. I always enjoyed hearing Bob, as I did this afternoon. And tomorrow morning, if you are here for Bob B's talk, it's going to be a real treat. I know that guy, and I love him, and I know you'll like very, very much what he has to say. And so I'm glad to be here this weekend. I'm glad to be here because my brother, Carl, is here. I'm glad to be here I have friends here that I knew before this afternoon. We had a chance to go out on Bob's boat. Bob P. has a boat that's anchored out here, and it's it was a colorful experience, is what it was. We went up river on the Columbia, and he murmured something about spawning when we were about an hour up. I don't know what the hell that meant, and I think his seamanship is absolutely superb. That little time that we were on the fantail singing Nearer My God to Thee meant nothing at all. It was just, frighten me and I'm fearless, Bob. That was just wonderful. I got a chance to take an nap. I guess I was nervous about talking here tonight. I took a snooze this afternoon, and I don't dream. At least I don't remember my dreams. And I fell asleep, and I had a dream that one of those silly, goofy things. It wasn't that I died and gone to heaven. It wasn't that kind of a thing. But I was standing at heaven's edge, looking in, and I could see people milling around there, and I was talking to some authority figure like St. Peter or somebody, and I saw one guy coming out of the mist over on this side, and I said, "That's my brother Carl," and he said, "That's right," and I noticed that he was accompanied by a little nasty looking thing about 3 feet high with warts all over it and wine sores and one thing and another. She was the ugliest thing I have ever seen. And I said, "Who is that with?" And they said, "Well, that's your brother Carl, all right. And he's up here, but he damn near didn't make it up here." And instead of sending him down there, they let him come up here. But for 5,000 years, he has to wander around up here with that nasty, ugly thing shackled to his arm. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cold. And then over here, coming out of the mist on this side was, I said, that's Diana. That's the delegate from the Oregon there. I know her. I met her. And they said, yeah, that's right. And she was shackled to some huge, ugly-looking thing. And I said, what happened? And they said, well, Diana damn near didn't make it up here, and instead of sending her down there, why, they let her come up for 10,000 years, so she has to wander around with that thing tagged to her like that. And I thought, oh, that's really awful. And then coming over here, in that dream I had, it showed, I saw Lenny coming across there, Lenny Z, and he was walking along. I said, who is that? I said, Lenny. He said, well, who's that with him? That looks like Raquel Welch. He said, yeah, that's who that is. And I said, I don't understand that. I mean, he's a nice guy, and he's a good member of AA, and he knows how to do all that kind of stuff, but Carl with that ugly thing, and Diana with that ugly thing, and Lenny with Raquel Welch, how did that happen? And he said, Raquel damn near didn't make it up. I love being sober. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have had more fun in Alcoholics Anonymous in the last almost 17 years now. I got sober on the 14th of August, 1966, in Glendale, California, and I have had an astonishingly rich and full life since that time. It's been astonishing. The journey from then to now is one that I could not possibly have imagined. You see, I'm just a drunk. I'm just a drunk. And for me to go that kind of time without taking a drink, without dropping a pill, without smoking any funny cigarettes, without abusing any chemicals, for me to have been able to go for that kind of time after giving up my right to chemical peace of mind is a miracle. It's just a flat miracle, and there's no other way to talk about it except in terms of miracle. Mike was talking earlier about the problem, and we know that problem so well, and he described it very well. And I grew up in that kind of an atmosphere where I had one parent that was a drunk, and the violence and the terrible sense of insecurity and unpredictability and the whole thing. I remember praying that I'd never be like that with my kids. And I became that kind of a person. And the fact that I don't live that way anymore is just astonishing. I guess what I'd like to do is talk about the solution tonight. Because there is one. Thank God. Thank God there's a solution for people like me and like you. If you're here tonight and maybe there's some people here. I know there are a couple that are here that are new in their experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I welcome you, and I hope that you find something here that allows you to go back next week to your area, wherever you live, and search out those AAs there, or reacquaint yourself with them, or continue to hang on to whoever it is that told you to come here this weekend. Because this kind of a celebration here tonight sustains us and buoys us and makes us feel absolutely wonderful and injects us with a great sense of the magnitude of the solution and a great sense that we are absolutely not alone and that we can, as a widely diverse group of people, each of us find an extraordinarily personal and effective answer to the problem here. And we get that great sense of knowing that this is a powerful thing. But AA has to work when we're not in a group like this. AA has to work just on the dog days. AA has to work when, if it's going to be anything at all, it has to work on those days when I can't quite remember how bad it was. And it does work on those days. It works, and it works well. And if it didn't work well on those days, I would be laying in the Glendale drunk tank tonight. Or be dead, or be permanently insane, or locked up someplace. It works, and it works well. And it's not, you know, the words in that book are so carefully chosen, it seems to me. They talk about trudging the road of happy destiny. Interesting word, trudge. Not exactly skip a long time. They don't hold on to any. And that's one of the things about the promises. They say, are these extravagant promises? And then it says, we think not. I think they're extravagant. And I think that's the beauty of it. Those extravagant promises are fulfilled in our lives. You bet they're extravagant. It seems to me they are. But they don't hold out any false hope, or they would have not used the word trudge. Because some days it's a trudge. And they don't say the road to happy destiny either. The road of happy destiny, the journey, is really wonderful. It really is. I love the journey. I love being sober, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no idea when I got here on the 14th of August, 1966, that I had taken my last drink. How would I have known that? If I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I think I'd have had two. A bail bondsman brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Deposited me there in that little club in Glendale. I call him every year on my birthday. He's as surprised as I am that this thing works for me. I really don't know why, and I've never gotten a satisfactory explanation from him as to why he took me to Alcoholics Anonymous instead of throwing me out of his office or just refusing to help me. It was clear that I needed something, but it was not anything that a bail bondsman would ordinarily provide. And this man put me in a car one hot Wednesday noon in Glendale and drove me across town, he and another man that was a member of AA, and took me up behind a laundry and up a long flight of stairs, and I walked into a room contained maybe 12 or 13 people sitting around tables in the back there. And I sat down there with you, and nothing in my life has been the same since. I was 29 years old, and I was bankrupt. I was living in a garage with three other guys. It was a double garage. I always throw that in. I want to... And if I didn't wake up in the garage, I woke up in jail. And that's the way it was. That's the way it was. I did some time for... When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a warrant out for bad checks. I had a warrant out for not paying child support. There was some awkwardness about drunk driving a time or two that was unresolved. The standard scar tissue was what I had picked up along the way. And I really didn't ever do anything. I didn't ask for this deal. I didn't want to be a drunk. And there it was. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you told me that if I were alcoholic, as you were alcoholic, I would always be alcoholic. If you're new here tonight, that may not be happy news for you. I kind of hoped that I could hang around about 6 weeks and be okay, because I'm a quick study and I'll pick it all up, and I knew this stuff, and turn your will and your life over the care of God was kind of like getting saved, and the rest of it was had a familiar ring to it from those church lessons we had, and from the Bible, and from the hellfire and brimstone and all the rest of it, and I knew about all that kind of stuff, and I wasn't going to have to stick around very long, and I was going to be on my way. And you said I would always be alcoholic if I were alcoholic then. And to prove the point, to really lock it down, to really hammer it home for me, a couple of those guys in that club in Glendale in 1966 said, you can change a cucumber into a pickle, but you can't change a pickle back into a cucumber. Oh, now that has a ring to it, doesn't it? Let me jot that down, Slim. That'll prove something to somebody, I'm sure. I'm really not into pickles and cucumbers. And I really was so grateful. A few years later, a friend of mine named Hank came through. And I know tonight I'm always going to be an alcoholic. That's just the way it is. I can't drink. I can't fly. I can't do several things. I can't drink. And I don't need to allow the things I can't do today to interfere with the things I can do. But I didn't know that then, and I struggled with it. But I understand it today, and I have for a number of years, and it's okay with me. I do not mind tonight. In fact, it's the only way that I can possibly think of that I could have gotten to a point in my life where I feel welcome and loved and comfortable most of the time. But in those days, it wasn't that easy, nor was it that clear. And when Hank came through, he talked about that, and he'd come to the conclusion that he was always going to be an alcoholic too. And he also knew by that time that when he died, he was going to will his body to science. And he got to thinking about how that might go. And he wondered when he went to the hospital in a terminal illness or after an accident and died, they'd probably do an autopsy and they'd take his kidneys out and put them in a drawer and they'd send his eyes down the hall to the eye bank and they would probably get around somehow or other to taking out his brain, and he figured they'd drop his brain in a jar of alcohol. And he wondered, as he thought about that, he figured, if that doctor listens real close, when he drops my brain into that jar of alcohol, he'll hear, laugh at these parts, it's funny. Well, I like that better than pickles and cucumbers. I went up to a guy when I was 5 days sober and I said, how do you get to sleep if you don't drink? If you're new here tonight, you will understand that that's an important question, and it is not easy to ask that kind of a question. I want to be cool, and it's hard to be cool and ask a question like that. And the guy said, do you really want to sleep tonight? And I said, yeah. He said, well, where do you live? And I said, I got a room down the street. I didn't tell him it was a garage. He said, do you live alone? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I'll tell you, just for openers, make your bed. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get housekeeping hints from these guys. I could have gotten that in the Marine Corps, you know. He said, I'll tell you something else you can do. After you get your bed made and get in it, say a little prayer to yourself. And he even told me the prayer. He said, say this, if God be for us, who can be against us? I thought, that's St. Paul. I never did like St. Paul. And I must have looked at him kind of funny, because he said, really? Make your bed. Put clean sheets on your bed. And I wondered how he knew about those sheets. The counselor never mentioned the sheets. The chaplain didn't bring it up. And here's some guy in the club in Glendale, California, telling me to put clean sheets on my bed and say a little prayer. Well, I've gone to bed in clean beds before, and I'm sure you had too. I've even said prayers. We said prayers when I was a kid. We had a lot of things we said. We memorized Bible verses. We listened to lots of sermons. I knew the books of the Bible and went to daily vacation Bible school. And I listened to my mother say, "Where will you spend eternity?" I don't know. Have you found God yet? No. I don't want to find God. I understand he's annoyed with me, and I don't want to go through all that. Here's one. What will you do when you meet your maker? Damned if I know what I'll do. And to bed with prayers. Now I lay me down to sleep. That doesn't help you. You get to that part about if I should die before I wake, that'll keep you awake a while. Just working. And here this old fool is in the club in Glendale telling me that I ought to say a prayer, make my bed, and everything is going to be just fine. This on the heels of I'll always be an alcoholic. I got back to my little room. I'm too cool for this. Is my problem. I'm standing there in a pair of Levi's and a t-shirt and tennis shoes and one sock on, and I'm too cool for this bird is what I am. But I got back to my, you know, this guy had a look about him, a look that people in AA have, and I've seen it in this hotel many times this week, this weekend. The look has been described as the Molokai look, the look of people that are consistently willing to give more than they get out of life. It's here. It's here. There's something here. I was up here a couple of weekends ago and discovered something that is here too, and that is that there is a deep, and I love it, there is a deep respect for Alcoholics Anonymous here, and I'm grateful to you for that. I'm grateful for that because I'm happy for you, and I'm glad to be a part of that here, but my brother stumbled into this deal with you a year ago and a couple of weeks ago, and he's caught that too. He caught it from you. And I thank you for the deep respect you have for the power of this program. And that's what that guy had that night. I didn't have it. I thought he was just nutty. But he had that look in his eye, that look that's here. The Molokai look is the look of people that went to the island of Molokai to work with the lepers. And they contracted the disease, some of them, and they didn't become prettier physically as a result. They became disfigured. But they decided to dedicate their lives to love and service. And something happens. It happened to them. It's happened to you. They got a look about them. The look of people that are consistently willing to give more than they get. And there it was. And so I took the chance to ask that goofy old guy in that club in Glendale how to get to sleep. And he gave me that pat for an answer. And I went back to my garage that night. With nothing at all going for me, except 5 days of not drinking, no faith, no pattern, no consistency, nothing in me but a series of failures, broken marriages, got out of the Marine Corps with an honorable discharge by the skin of my teeth, thrown out of the dental school up here on the hill in 1961. If anybody was a patient at the dental school. In 59, 60, or 61, I'd like to make my amends tonight. And there we were. And I'm standing in my little room. It was a double garage and then cut up into four rooms, and I had one of the rooms, and it's a linoleum floor and a bed and a light coming out of the ceiling and a sink. And the floor of the linoleum floor is, there's a couple of touches that give you a clue as to how I live. Those alcoholic rooms have a couple of touches. There's an odor there. I'd had a bad run of mattresses that spring. The linoleum floor is sticky. You can hear yourself walking across that baby. And there is an obligatory copy of Playboy laying there. We don't give up romance easily, do we? And I'm about 30 minutes away from this conversation with this guy that obviously has no idea the seriousness of my situation, because he wants me to put clean sheets on my bed and say a stupid prayer. And I'm not much into that business, because I have gone to bed in clean beds before and I have said those dumb little prayers and they don't help you get to sleep. And if you can't get to sleep, what happens is you lay there and you stare at the ceiling and those old tapes that are laying around in your head begin to play, and all the nickel and dime compromises of my life kind of float to the surface and like ugly things in a nasty pond, and I don't like to look at them. And there's a lot of them, and none of them are pretty. None of them make any sense. In no instance was any evil lessened or any good strengthened. No battles have been won. No lessons taught. It's just a series of silly little compromises I've made with myself over the years, and I can't stand it when I think of it. A marriage gone bad, another one. Mistreating wives and children. And I don't sleep. In about 5 minutes to one, I'll get up and run out and buy a pint and knock myself out that way. Except I can't, because I've been 5 days with you, and I know. I know that something around here works for you. And I know that if I do that, I'm going to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'll have it to do all over again. And so there's one more thing I got going for me, and that is, while that guy is a silly old coot, he knew about those sheets. And that's important. And so, without any faith that it would work at all, I made that bed. I found some clean sheets someplace. Put them on that bed. I got in the bed and said that dumb little prayer. I knew it wouldn't work. I woke up at 7 o'clock the next morning. I'd slept all night long. And the fact that I knew it wouldn't work did not keep it from working. And that message was lost on me then, but I went back to it time and time again. I nourished myself with that little silly lesson, because it's happened to me time and again. And if you're new here tonight, if you're new in your experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, you must be like me and know that this will not work for you. Be of good cheer. If you know this will not work for you, and if you know you are beyond redemption, and if you know absolutely that you can hang around and smile and pretend for 4 or 5 weeks and then you must go again, welcome. Welcome. Because this deal works for people like you and me. If you're a shortcut artist, if you're one of those people that would just rather talk about it than do it, if you're absolutely certain that you're going to be able to find somebody around here to work these 12 steps for you, you're in the right place. My sponsor has an interesting story that he used to tell about a guy that was in a fishing village in Alaska, and he didn't really thrive there, but he survived there in this fishing village. And the way he survived is he went at the end of the day from one to a fishing boat, At the end of the day, they'd be in port with their catch, and he'd say to the skipper, "Give me a piece of fish." And they'd throw him a piece of fish, and he'd scuttle off someplace, and he'd cook up his fish and find a place to sleep, and there he survived. And one day he had bad luck, the kind of bad luck I've had with you. He went up to a guy who said, "I can't give you a piece of fish." And he said, "Don't be silly, you've got a whole boat full of fish there." He says, "I can't give you a piece of fish. It's not in me to do that." He said, "Come on, give me a piece of fish. Everybody gives me fish." He said, "I'll tell you what I can do. I can bring you aboard and teach you how to fish. But it's not in me to do so little as to give you a piece of fish. To give you a piece of fish is to give you nothing. If I'm going to give you something, let me give you a gift. Let me teach you how to fish." And the guy was just like me, because he said, "Nah, I don't want to be bothered. I don't want to take up your time. I don't want to be a nuisance to you. You know what I mean? Now, give me a piece of fish." And I was just like, go to a meeting every night? Give me a piece of fish. Don't make me go to a meeting every night. Well, of course I drank every night, but never mind that. I don't want to put the same energy into the recovery as I did into the problem. Give me a piece of fish. Don't make me write an inventory. Give me a piece of fish. Don't make me make amends to those people. And I had the extraordinary bad luck to run into a bunch of people in AA that would not give me a piece of fish. Refused to. Insisted on teaching me how to fish. I'll tell you how bad it got. I went to my sponsor one day with a problem, and the problem is that I hated my ex-wife. She and my little boy lived there in Santa Monica, and she was a stinker. Oh, she was just a hateful thing. And I went to my sponsor with that terrible problem. And he told me something that I found difficult to believe. He said, "If you want to change how your problem is, you hate your ex-wife, right?" "Right." He said, "If you want to change how you feel about somebody, you have to change how you treat them." And I said, "Yes, I know, and I'll do that when she shapes up. I'm going to..." And he said, "I think that we've had this discussion before." I said, "No, we haven't." He said, "Didn't we talk about child support?" And I said, oh, that." He said, "How's that going?" I said, "Well..." I didn't really get into it with him, but I wasn't Johnny at the rat hole with that child support. I'd send it a week late. I'd send it, but I'd send part of it. I'd go over there and give it to her in person and tell her how to spend it. I was really cute with the child support. In those days, I didn't have a checking account. In fact, I didn't have a checking account until I was 5 years sober. I don't do well with a checking account. Now, that's changed, but when I came in here, there was a warrant out for my arrest for writing bad checks while I was drinking. And I had to go back to jail when I was 5 months sober for a day to take care of that. And so I didn't get it. I went into the bank and got money orders on payday, because I didn't want any more trouble with the checking account. Oh, they hated to see me coming in the bank some days if they were busy. I had a list. And I'd go in and I'd say, "I need 12 money orders in these amounts." And sometimes they were fine and they'd give me the money order. Sometimes I'd say, "Mr. Hodges, if you had a checking account, you could write these checks for 10 cents a piece, and we have to charge you 35 cents for these money." And I'd say, I know, but it's... If I was feeling ornery, I'd say, "You know, when I write a check, it usually costs me about $100 and several days in jail." So sometimes she got a money order and sometimes she didn't. Sometimes I'd take it over there in cash and give her a bad time about it. I was really a drag, is what I was. And he said, if you want to change how you feel about her, you got to change how you treat her. And in your case, it means you've got to send the money on payday. It wasn't more than I could afford. It was just that it seemed like, since I rebel against authority, and that was a big authority thing. A court said I had to do that. And she said I had to do that. And he said, you have to do it. Not for her, for you. Get it over there every payday. First thing, right off the top, get a money order over there in the mail. Do not take it over in person. And he said, I'll tell you something else. If you can't get it over there, you can get yourself another sponsor. I mean, we're kind of in the no fish category again, right? So I knew he meant business, so I began to do that. I added one more money order, and I had to have the envelope ready and a stamp on the envelope, because if I got very far away from the post box that was in that bank, I was in trouble. If I waited till Tuesday, I was almost always in trouble, and I had to get that sent in there because it went against every negative instinct in me to send that money. And I did it, and I did it, and I did it, and I did it. About 5 months went by, and I'm driving down the freeway, and I'm with a guy that I was sponsoring at the time, and now I am a couple of years sober. I mean, I'm old enough to have picked up a few things around AA, but I'm not a quick study, and I'm popping this, playing these games with child support, and I'm driving down the freeway with this guy, and by this time, I'm paying child support every payday. And I got a guy in my car, and he's screaming about his ex-wife, and his problem was that she was a bad mother. Well, I don't know if she was a bad mother or not, but it was a nice bag to get into, so I got into that bag with him, and we're howling away about his ex-wife. And I had a funny thing happen to me. I suddenly realized, for the first time ever, that lady may be a big stinker, and I may never like her, but she is an excellent mother to my son. And that's the first positive thought I'd had about her in years. And he was a toddler at the time. And I thought, wow, and nothing had changed. She hadn't shaped up. The only thing that was different was I was paying child support. And I continued to pay it. And I hope I don't forget soon what happened that toward that end of the year. She called me up one day. It was December, early in December. And she said she needed the money and needed it a couple of weeks early. And could I possibly get that money scraped together and send it over to her? Just because she needed it. I must have changed even since that last thought about it. Because I found myself going over there to give her that money in person. Just because she needed it. And that's not like me. I'm not what you'd call a compulsive child support payer. And I do a lot of things that are self-destructive, and I do a lot of things because I have that gut feeling I don't deserve to treat myself any better, and I tend to take it all out on other people. And my dad used to say, when are you going to be a man? And I didn't think I'd ever make it. And I began to feel better about her, and she called, and I found myself going over there to give her that money on a December evening, 1969, I guess. Just because she needed it, I handed her that money. I spent a minute or two talking to my youngster. We were going to go play ball that Saturday. And I walked down the stairs from her apartment and heard that Christmas music and saw some of the early decorations. It was a brisk December evening in Santa Monica, California, and I had a strange feeling. I don't know. That I'd ever had it before. I felt more like a man than I had ever felt before. I mean, there's not enough money in the state of California to buy me the feeling. There's not enough booze to make me forget it if I don't have it. And I learned something important. There really is a payoff. The whole deal about the child support is for me. But it had some extraordinary results. I continued to do that through good times and bad, through days when there was money and days when there wasn't so much money, because there, that seemed to me to be an important commitment to make. And I do it today. And the result of it is, that kid is one of these kids that has a splendid interior. He's one of these kids that is just... Well, I love him very much. And we have a good relationship today. And I think I can allow that to happen between us because I haven't ducked the responsibility. One of the nice things about being in Portland this weekend and being with you tonight is that kid is here with me tonight, here with us. I'd like you to meet him. His name is Michael. Stand up and say hi to these guys, Mike. He's a hell of a kid. He came down to visit Pat and me a couple of months ago, and we had a lot of fun and laughs and some good talks, and he knows I love him. And I could have missed it all, except you wouldn't give me a piece of fish. You insisted that I go first class, and that's the solution to this whole business, is that we have to do certain things. And if you're new here tonight... and know that you can never have any kind of a thing like that. I'm glad you're here. And I'll tell you something else. If you stick around, Alcoholics Anonymous, your ex-wife will be glad you're here. But she won't be as half as glad as you will be. Because you're the one that's going to get the benefits of all of this. You see, this thing works in my life on a consistent day-by-day basis because it just works if I take these actions. I have to at some point come to terms with it. I have to at some point say, all right, I will turn my will and my life over to... You know how scary that is? If you're new here tonight, I know you'll never do that. I won't ever do that because we were in the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, and the minister would get everybody worked up into a lather and they'd come down to the front to get saved. And then they turned into people that didn't look like they were real happy about being saved. My uncle went down there and they sent his butt to China to be a missionary. And I knew if I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God... he's either going to make me go to China or I got to go back with that ex-wife. And you know, the day came. It took a while, but the day came when I was on my knees by my bed in an apartment in Santa Monica, California. I thought, if I don't do this thing, I'll have to get ready for the streets because I'm just a drunk. No human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. I know that. God could and would if he were sought. I didn't even hear that for years. I heard that old echo from my past, God can and might if you can find him. But it's just like it doesn't say... if we were wrong, promptly admitted it. It says, when we were wrong. Abraham Lincoln is supposed to have said that he'd been driven to his knees many times by the firm conviction that he had no place else to go, when his wisdom and that of all about him were simply insufficient for that day. And there I was in that same... position on my knees, and for a time I turned my will and my life over to the care of God. I grab it back and grab it back, but it stayed there long enough for me to realize that's a safe place for my... he doesn't want me in China. He wants me to stay in town and pay child support is what he seems to have in mind. But I'll tell you something else. He wants me to have fun. He wants me to have a rich, abundant life. He wants me to be able to come to Portland and laugh and cry with you. I guess I'm here. If he didn't love me, didn't want me to have a good life, I'd be in that drunk tank in Glendale tonight, you know. It's no mystery to me. I mean, I'm just a drunk. And there's a solution. And if you're new here tonight, it'll work for you. I sat in a meeting one night. I didn't believe it'll work for me. I knew these steps won't work for me. Oh, they work for you. Sure they do. I watch you come in here and I look in your eyes and there's nobody home. And in about a month, your eyes are inhabited again. I've seen it happen too many times not to know that this program works for you. But there's something in me that makes me know that these steps won't work for me. I'm afraid to work them. What if I'll work them and they won't work for me, and where do I go then? Parents without partners? I mean, I need answers. And I was sitting in a meeting one night in Brentwood, California, about that same time, and I was listening to the guy that wrote that pamphlet, A Member's Eye View of AA, Alan McGinnis, died sober a couple of years later. And he was a wonderfully gifted man, and I loved him a lot because he just always seemed to say something I needed to hear. And that night he said something I've never forgotten. He says, "The steps don't know who it is that's taken them. They'll work for anybody." I jumped in there and took a couple of those things before they found out it was me. These steps work. They work. I heard so much about potential when I was a kid growing up. I had always that feeling that other people got secret instruction in how to get along in this world that I never got. I was so aware of that plight that Peggy Lee sings about. Is that all there is? Is that it? A new wife, a newborn son, a job, a car. Doesn't seem to have the promise that it should have. It doesn't seem to deliver. Is that it? Is that all I'm going to get out of life? You might as well keep on dancing and break out the booze. I knew those problems time and time and time again. And I knew that there wasn't any job that would hold me. There wasn't any kind of an interesting career. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was selling encyclopedias door to door. My worldwide headquarters was the garage. After I'd been with you for a while, you told me we were self-supporting through our own contributions, and I got another job selling advertising specialties, imprinted ballpoint pens, calendars, that kind of stuff. And I did that for a year, and then I got a job selling dictating equipment, and I slowly learned to get to work 5 days a week in a row. I slowly learned to get those money orders lined up and pay my bills. I slowly learned that it didn't matter whether... Interesting thing about it, it didn't matter whether I wanted to do it or not. You never have asked me whether I wanted to do it. It just never seemed to come up. Will you wash the coffee pot? Okay, I'm glad they didn't ask me if I wanted to. They just said, "Wash the coffee pot." Oh, all right. Sometimes I kind of volunteer that it didn't seem to be anything I wanted to do, and I was assured every time that it didn't matter. I could go ahead and do it without wanting to. It was all right. My lucky day. So I sold dictating equipment. I sold a little computer. I sold carpets. I'd come out of the Marine Corps at the end of 1965 with I was a field artillery officer. They're not defending the factories with cannon anymore, and so I didn't really blend nicely into a civilian occupation. That's the only skill I had, that and dealing with the bailiff. And, of course, standing in front of the judge in the municipal court in Glendale saying, "Guilty, Your Honor." I was good at that. I did it a lot. Guilty, Your Honor. Well, I'm not doing that anymore, and I'm not real happy with what I'm doing. And I heard a guy down there say, if you're working 5 days a week just to get the two freebies at the end, you're cheating yourself. And I knew people that were living 7 days a week that loved their job, that really had their heart in how they earned their living, that were anxious to get in there in the morning and not leaving at a dead run at the end of the day. And I wanted that too. And I somehow or other had it pointed out to me that maybe this higher power that you'd been telling me about had a capacity to put into my head something that I could... See, people would say, well, what do you want to do? And I'd say, I don't know. I know what I don't want to do. Isn't that effective? I had a long list of things I didn't want to do. How interesting, right? Finally said, tear up that list. And mentally I did. The list existed in my head. And the answer was there. As soon as I opened up my head, I don't know how long it took, but it wasn't long. I was helping somebody move. Pat the other night talked about helping people move. And I was in the back of a stake bed truck heading down the street, and I was holding down a dresser, and a guy that was holding down the dresser poked his head around the corner and said, you know, Clint, you ought to go to law school. I was 5 years sober by that time almost, and I'd never considered that. I began to look into it. I promised I'd keep an open mind on it, and I pried my mind back open, and I said, okay, I'll look at that. And I gathered transcripts, and I applied, and I found out it took 4 years. I had to go at night. I got to work during the day, and I got to go to meetings. I have to go to school at night. It could be done at night, but it took 4 years. I went back to him. I said, you know how old I'll be in 4 years if I go to law school? How old will you be in 4 years if you don't go to law school? Oh. And I started. And somehow it all got done. They hooked me. Sometime in that first year, I found out that this was exciting. And I liked it. And then I began to wonder if I'd make it. And then I was... How do you keep AA first? And it has to be first. If you're new here tonight and think AA is something we superimpose on something else just because it's convenient to go to a meeting, I got bad news for you. AA is first. Or we can't keep this thing. And if we can't keep it, we can't have anything else. It's a paradoxical thing. This Alcoholics Anonymous, at least from my experience and the people that I know well, thrive in every department of their life if they keep Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon first. And don't do so hot if something else gets in the way. And when the heat was on and exam time was coming up, I'd waffle with it, and then I'd shove it back down into second place and get to a meeting or do some AA commitment or take care of whatever it was, and the 4 years go by. And I stood in a graduation ceremony and Whittier, California, at the Whittier College of Law in 1975. Lots of AAs there. And got a Juris Doctor degree. Can't do much with that without a license to practice law. And until you take and pass the California State Bar Examination, no license. And that's a tough, grueling 3-day examination. You write like crazy for 3 days in downtown Los Angeles, and getting ready for it is a colorful event. And a lot of guys don't make it. I think the last count was 27% passed it last time in California. So I knew it was a tough examination. But, you know, for those people, those normal people, those people that didn't have a history as rich as mine... Filling out the application is just an easy thing, but that application gets a little tricky for people like me because they want to know who you are. They, for example, wanted to know my residence addresses since I was 16 years old. That's a lot of addresses. 2 weeks here, a month there. Had to list a Pontiac. Places all around this town, up on the hill, down around, all over the place. Have you ever been arrested for anything other than a minor traffic violation? Went one of the questions. Then they leave three little lines there. I put see attached page right. And on it went. And I didn't want to tell them all of that stuff because I knew they wouldn't find out all of it. Divorces and this and that. I don't look so hot on paper. And I knew there's some that they can't find out about. And do you really tell them all of that? And I went to my sponsor. Give me a piece of fish. He told me an interesting thing. He didn't moralize. He didn't do anything. He said, if you put down part of it and they allow you to take the test, you will not be able to get ready for the test because you will have the secret thought in the back of your mind that they will catch you on part of what you've lied about and wash you out anyway. And I knew he was right. He said, if you put down everything, whether they can find out about it or not, and then they let you take the test, you can give it everything you've got to get ready for that test, and there will be nothing psychologically that'll hold you back. Your mind won't hold you back. And I knew that. I knew he was right, and I finally did it. I just gave him the whole deal. And at the end of it, I was able to say, these problems that I've described to you resulted from a drinking problem I used to have. It was then 1975, I said. In 1966, 9 years ago, I joined AA, and I haven't had a drink since I joined, and I haven't had a related problem since that time, and I signed my name, and I sent it, bundled it up with twine, and sent it off. And they let me take their test. And then I waited for 4 months to find out if I'd passed it. And on Thanksgiving Eve in 1975, I got a call from a guy that I sponsored that worked at one of the papers in Los Angeles. And he said, we got the list from Sacramento. Your name is on that list. And I wondered what list he had. I had passed that test. The next morning was Thanksgiving Day, and at breakfast, I began to cry. I thought, that is just astonishing. Okay, and of course, by that afternoon, I was thinking, you know, they really ought to tighten it up to keep those dumb bastards out of this thing. I mean, that arrogance comes back pretty fast, but I love it. I just love it. I love the practice of law, and I have a lot of fun with it. An odd thing happened. One day, I was back over in Glendale. A couple of years went by, and I was back over there one morning. In Glendale, they have the municipal courts on the first floor, where I'd appeared so often. One flight up is the Superior Courts. And I was in the Superior Court that morning on a case, they called it, and I answered ready. Ready for the defendant. Took care of whatever it was, not a big deal. Felt pretty good about it, got a nice result. And came back down the stairs and walked out toward the parking lot. And just as I got past that courtroom where Judge Ken White had sat on the bench for years, where I had stood so many times, somebody walked out of that courtroom and I looked down and there was Judge Ken White on the bench in that courtroom. And there was somebody, my replacement, standing there in front of me. And it's not, you know, that thought is so obvious. For me to get from being the defendant in municipal court, up one flight answering ready for the defendant, is not a likely journey for me to make. Can't be done. Cannot be done. It can't be done. If you're new here tonight, you have cut your problems in half just by coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you may be that you may stand around, you may be here to become the biggest miracle of all. I don't know what the future holds for you, but you cut your problems in half just by coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because this thing will work. It'll work for you. I mean, the trip for me has been and continues to be an astonishing trip. Pat and I have had a lot of fun here this weekend with you, and we're very grateful to have been included in this weekend. And we have a lot of fun where we go and where we live, and we can laugh with each other and have a lot of fun. She loves me enough to love AA more, and that gives me a sense of security. And so we have a lot going for us, and it can happen for you too. You may not be alcoholic, or you may wonder if you're alcoholic, and mainly you don't really have a burning desire to stop drinking, if you're like me. Welcome aboard. If you're willing to become willing, to become willing. To look into the possibility of becoming willing. To become willing to postpone one drink one day. You're in the right place. I'll tell you something. I'll tell you a little interesting story. My mom used to say, "What will you do when you meet your maker?" And I really used to wonder how that would turn out and what I would possibly say if she were here tonight to ask me, "What will you do when you meet your maker?" And I thought for some years that I would say, "Well, I'll tell him I got to AA finally. And I made amends to those people. And I have fun with Michael now. And his mother and I respect one another today. And I have a good life." I used to think I might say something like that. But if she, I know today I couldn't say that at all. If she were here today and would say to me, "What will you do when you meet your maker?" I could say, and it's the most marvelous thing I know about my life, I could say, "We've already met. Those guys in that club in Glendale introduced us in 1966. We're good friends. My life has been extraordinary since then." If you're new here tonight, that'll happen to you too. I promise you that. Don't drink. Come to lots of meetings. Hang on. This thing works. There's a solution, and we have found it, and we are glad to share it with you. Thank you.